拜登表示，普京应受战争罪审判，美国推动暂停俄罗斯的联合国人权理事会成员资格。欧洲多国谴责俄军在乌克兰滥杀平民，寻求新一轮对俄制裁。美国之音专访前美海军陆战队员，俄军为何难打赢乌克兰战争。各位观众大家好，我是卡拉，欢迎收看美国观察。拜登总统星期一呼吁对俄罗斯总统普京进行战争罪审判，同时欧盟正与乌克兰合作调查俄罗斯在乌克兰犯下的战争罪与反人类罪，并搜集证据。今天的节目中我们一同关注。拜登总统星期一呼吁对俄罗斯总统普京进行战争罪审判，由于俄军在乌克兰涉嫌滥杀平民，莫斯科面临全球新一波的声讨和谴责。拜登总统谴责普京要为俄军在乌克兰首都基辅近郊布查所犯下的暴行负责。多国领导人指责俄罗斯滥杀平民的行为犯下了战争罪行。乌克兰官方表示，近日从俄军手中收复首都基辅周边城镇之后，发现了410具平民的遗体。美联社报道说，该社记者在基辅西北部的布查市亲眼目睹了21具平民遗体，其中一组身着平民服装的9具遗体被凌乱地遗弃在当地居民说之前被用作俄军阵地的地方。这些人看上去都是近距离被枪杀身亡的，其中至少2人被射杀时手臂被捆绑在背后。乌克兰总统泽连斯基以及一些西方国家领袖将俄军犯下的暴行称作是种族灭绝，然而北京至今对俄罗斯的对乌克兰的入侵和暴行保持沉默。面对席卷全球的震怒和谴责，俄罗斯国防部星期天发表声明，声称这些曝光的照片和视频是基辅政府为西方媒体导演操弄的。声明说，布查市在俄军占领期间没有一个平民因任何形式的暴力行为死亡。拜登总统说，在看见布查市平民遭杀害的悲惨景象之后，他认为这可构成对俄罗斯总统普京的战争罪审判。而美国除了打算对俄罗斯施加更多的制裁，也寻求暂停俄罗斯在联合国人权理事会的成员资格。详细情况请美国之音白宫记者黄耀毅来介绍。耀毅。
是美国总统拜登呢，星期的时候早上的时候，他表示呢，在看到了这个俄罗斯在乌克兰布查地区残杀平民的景象之后，他现在认为这个俄罗斯总统普京可以来用战争罪犯的罪名来做审判。我们看一下拜登总统今天早上怎么说的。
You may remember I got criticized for calling Putin a war criminal. Well, the truth of the matter is so what happened in Ukraine.This warrants him, he is a war criminal. But we have to gather the information. We have to continue to provide Ukraine with the weapons they need to continue the fight. And we have to gather all the detail so this can be an actual, have a war crime trial. This guy is brutal. And what's happening in Bucha is outrageous.
那拜登总统说呢，美国接下来将跟盟友伙伴们推出对俄罗斯更多的制裁，并且持续的对乌克兰进行更多的军事援助。而白宫的国安顾问沙利文在星期一下午的白宫新闻简报会上呢，说明了针对这个战争罪审判要来怎么做的可能采取的做法。我们看一下国安顾问沙利文怎么说。
We had already concluded that Russia committed war crimes in Ukraine, and the information from Bucha appears to show further evidence of war crimes.And as the president said, we will work with the world to ensure there is full accountability for these crimes. We have to consult with our allies and partners, on what makes most sense as a mechanism moving forward. Obviously, the ICC is, one venue where war crimes, have been tried in the past, but there have been other examples in other conflicts of other mechanisms being set up.
是拜登总统有说到呢，要收集更多的证据，而这边白宫顾问沙利文也说呢，美国将会透过四个来源的收集俄罗斯的战争罪行。第一个呢，就是美国与盟友合作，透过广大的情报网来搜证；第二个呢，就是乌克兰人民在地的记录；第三个就是透过国际组织，包括联合国与各种非政府组织来收集证据；第四呢，就是透过各大媒体的报道。而美国的联合国大使格林菲尔德在星期也说呢，将会从联合 国当中提出终止俄罗斯在人权理事会当中的资格。白宫发言人沙奇在今天下午也证实呢，说这个联合国大使这样的做法正是出自于拜登总统的授意。他也说呢，拜登总统认为让俄罗斯继续留在联合国人权理事会当中根本就是荒谬的。那么适当的下一步呢，也就是会把俄罗斯整个逐出人权理事会。而对于这个现在俄罗斯在乌克兰做法是否已经构成了种族灭绝，那么包括我们现在我们可以听到了，在白宫的外面现在就很多的支持乌克兰民众就在呼吁说，请拜登政府将这个俄罗斯呢在乌克兰的做法列为种族灭绝。不过呢，在今天的白宫新闻简报会上，包括白宫的国安顾问以及白宫发言人都表示说呢，这个要像当初在缅甸对罗兴亚人做成是种族灭绝这样子的一个行为呢，是需要经过多年的调查来证明说的确有系统性的进行种族灭绝清洗的行为。那目前呢，在俄罗斯在乌克兰的做法呢还没有构成这样子的一个证据能够来列为种族灭绝。那同时呢，也被问到说呢，如果今天拜登政府也已经把中国对于维吾尔人的做法认为是种族灭绝的话呢，是否下一步也要把中国也逐出联合国的人权理事会之外。对此呢，白宫发言人沙奇则表示，现在美国政府在关心的最专注进行的呢是在俄罗斯的方面，还有俄罗斯对乌克兰入侵以及在布查的凄惨的景象。那不过呢，只要是美国所关切的人权侵犯问题，包括是中国的人权侵犯，美国都会继续的在公开以及私底下来进行关切。卡拉，
好的，感谢耀毅发自白宫的报道。俄罗斯在乌克兰首都基辅市郊布查滥杀平民的暴行引起了美国及欧洲多国的谴责，多个欧洲大国都表示这是战争罪行，需要对俄罗斯加强制裁。下面我们连线美国之音驻伦敦特约记者郑乐杰来了解详情。乐杰你好。
卡拉你好。我们刚刚也可以，嗨，不好意思。
是因为我首先想请教你的是，因为我们刚才说到这个俄罗斯在布查滥杀平民的这个事件是引起了几乎全球范围的震怒和谴责，先给我们介绍一下这方面的情况好吗？
好的。刚刚我们也可以看到一些新闻图片，一些新闻片段，所以我们看到布查这个镇现在是遍及四海，还有有些人刚刚说到是双手绑在背后，是被处决的这样子情况，有些宠物也被杀掉，所以这个情况是这样。昨天我们看到泽连斯基这个乌克兰总统，他是邀请当年2008年就是拒绝乌克兰加入北约的法国前总统萨尔科齐跟这个德国前总理默克尔，他们邀请他们到布查里看一看，他都说要他们看一看在他们14年前没有做好对俄罗斯这个软弱的取态，现在是做成怎样的后果。我们也可以看到一张法新社的照片，看到泽连斯基到现场看的时候，他满面都是悲伤，跟我们一直看到他这个个人的形象很不同，他几乎是哭出来，他掩着自己脸不要哭出来这样的情况，所以他也说这是战争罪行，这是种族灭绝。当然他去布查的时候也有为这个当地的乌克兰军打气，也有慰问这个当地幸存的居民，但他也提到一个重点，就是说俄军在当地留下了很多地雷，包括在屋子里面有，在一些留下的军事装备上面有，包括在尸体上面也有，这个是很严重的事情，所以他这个说法是对他来讲是战争罪行。
是，那么对于目前这个俄罗斯侵略乌克兰的这些情况，欧洲方面是怎样回应的呢？是否会准备采取新的行动？
有的。德国总理朔茨表示他会有西方盟友会有新一轮的制裁，他没有说是什么，但他就说未来几天就会有。他普京跟他的支持者会感受到这个效果。法国总统马克龙也说会有制裁，他就比较清楚说是在煤跟汽油方面的供应的制裁。当然英国首相约翰逊也说他认为这是战争罪行，所以他会用一切的方法，他可能用的方法去榨干普京的这个战争机器，但他没有讲清楚是怎样的制裁跟军事援助乌克兰。 德国的国防部长说，欧盟他必须讨论怎样去禁止俄罗斯这个天然气进口。但我们之前也说过，欧盟从俄罗斯进口的天然气高达40%，它怎样可以从在短时间内减少这个供应是很，就怎样去找一个新的供应是很大的问题。但波兰的总理也有一个有趣的说法，他说其实欧盟要制裁俄罗斯的最大阻碍是德国本身。那我们一直被认为是亲中或者亲俄的匈牙利反而不是问题，因为匈牙利是支持制裁的。那刚刚匈牙利的总理欧尔班他赢得了第四个任期，但他这个态度是很微妙的，他是唯一一个批评泽连斯基乌克兰总统的一个欧洲领袖，他不允许武器给乌克兰，但同时他也谴责俄罗斯对乌克兰的战事，所以我们不知道匈牙利的真正态度是什么。但我们可以看到最直接的就是立陶宛，他今天就说他把这个俄罗斯在立陶宛的大使赶出去，要他回到俄罗斯去，所以这是欧洲国家里面最直接的行动。
是，另外现在我们知道这个乌克兰难民的问题也是吸引了来自全球这个国际上的关注，能不能给我们介绍一下现在乌克兰难民的这个安置和这个撤离的情况是怎么样的？
好的，乌克兰来讲已经有根据联合国有420万难民逃出的国家，大概是那个国家的1/10人口，最大的是波兰，大概到了245万，其他的几十万都到其他国家，比如罗马尼亚、摩尔多瓦跟匈牙利等等。德国也说有30万已经在那边登记了之后成难民。那昨天波兰他向乌克兰难民发出了62万5千个身份证，那在未来十八个月，这些乌克兰难民他们都在波兰可以工作，可以有免费的教育、免费的医疗等等的福利。但在另外一个方面，在英国也是欢迎乌克兰难民的，但他没有这样开放。一个有趣的情况就是英国的交通大臣叫做沙普斯，他说他自己在 Facebook 上面找到一个乌克兰家庭，想把他们带回去，但是他自己是一个高级官员，也花了2-3个星期都没有这个回应，所以他说，他也说英国的申请真的是很慢。根据数字，到上个星期三为止，英国只处理了28000个申请的1/10。
好的，感谢美国之音驻伦敦特约记者乐杰带来的报道。
谢谢。
在美国的敦促下，西班牙周一在西班牙的马约卡岛的一个船厂扣押了俄罗斯寡头维克托·维克塞尔伯格的游艇。这艘名为“探戈”的游艇长78米，价值超过$99,000。这是自俄罗斯入侵乌克兰以来，美国首次参与没收属于俄罗斯寡头的财产。这是美国司法部新成立的捕获盗贼特别工作组采取的行动，预计该工作组将追查俄罗斯寡头持有的更多资产。维克塞尔伯格已经是美国多项制裁的对象，其中包括因俄罗斯入侵乌克兰而施加的制裁。他尚未就扣押游艇事件发表评论。西班牙还扣押了其他俄罗斯寡头拥有的另外3艘游艇。
当今真相为重，掌握全球脉动，只要点击 VOA Plus， 手指移动信息即来，追踪政治动向，体验真实生活，世界各地的声音随时随地轻松获取。现在就下载 VOA Plus 应用程序 VOA Plus。
欢迎继续收看美国观察。 俄乌战争进入第二个月，俄军想要占领乌克兰主要城市的第一阶段目标以失败告终。而刚刚实地探访了战争前线的美国前海军陆战队员埃略特·阿克曼认为，俄军僵化的中央集权式指挥模式、乌克兰反装甲武器的优越性以及乌军的顽强决心，使得乌克兰正在赢得这场战争。来看美国之音记者平章的报道。
Mr. Ackerman, thank you very much for taking my interview today. A Russian rocket struck the western Ukrainian city of Lviv on March 26, while President Biden was visiting neighboring Poland. You were in Lviv that day, covering for Time magazine. So please tell us what you've witnessed on the ground when and after the bombing happened.
Well, you know, rockets have been consistently falling on most major Ukrainian cities, to include Lviv, although the rocketing there has not been as intense as cities in the east. That being said, probably on any given day, there will be at least 2 to 3 air raid warnings in Lviv, where everyone has to go down into a bomb shelter. So that day in the afternoon, the rockets struck just to the north of the city at an oil refinery. And when you came out from the bomb shelter, you could see, you know, thick black clouds of smoke billowing up and hovering over the city.
You also visited Kyiv. So how was people holding up over there? What impressed you the most?
Kyiv, given the degree of fighting that's gone on there, is very tense. There is a heightened security presence on all of the streets. The streets are also heavily defended with sandbag barricade and army outposts. So Kyiv has really seen, you know, some pretty intense fighting on the outskirts. And at any given time, you can hear outgoing artillery, as well as those exchanges happening in some of the suburbs around Kyiv.
As the conflict moved into its second month, Russian forces have largely failed in their first aim to take the largest cities. As a former intelligence officer, do you believe the, you know, Russia's stalled advance was possibly because of Putin's intelligence failure or miscalculation?
This Russian intelligence failure is a huge part of why the Russian army has had such a difficult time in Ukraine. The Russians fundamentally underestimated the Ukrainians, did not understand the depth and passion of Ukrainian resolve, these people's desire to live in their own free, independent country. And it would seem there was an assumption on the part of the Russians that they would be able to inspire divisions in Ukraine and, so divided, be able to at least annex a good chunk of the country, if not the whole country. And that is just absolutely not proven the case. You know, the very big story here is the resolve of the Ukrainians.
You once compared the centralized command and control used by the Russian military and the decentralized mission-style command and control used by the Ukrainian forces. Would you please elaborate on this? How does it play out in the fact that Russia had such a difficult time gaining ground?
At a fundamental level, the Russian army and the Western NATO armies have very different philosophies in how they wage war. And this goes all the way back decades, if not centuries, Soviet times and before. In so much as, you know, Western militaries rely on what are called mission style tactics, meaning everyone from a 22-year-old corporal up to a general understands deeply the mission, why they're there, what they're trying to achieve. And the reason for that is that when command and control breaks down, when in the chaos of war, if everyone understands the mission, even if the plan isn't working and nothing is going according to plan, and even if people can't talk, if everyone understands the mission, they can adapt to get the mission done, to complete the mission. So that's mission style tactics. You know, the Russians have a very centralized command structure where all decision making is made in one place, where plans are very tightly orchestrated and choreographed. And that can work well if everything is going according to plan. But the weakness of that system is that when things don't go according to plan, the junior soldiers don't have a good idea of why they're there, what their mission is. And you quickly see chaos develop when you have that centralized planning structure, as we've seen in Ukraine. And I think a great example of this was, if we remember early on after the Russian invasion, there was a 40-mile-long convoy leading down to Kyiv. And that convoy that was 40 miles sitting there was really a traffic jam. And there was a breakdown amongst the Russian command and control when things didn't go according to plan, where none of these vehicles knew what they were supposed to do. And so we're really seeing in Ukraine today two diametrically opposed philosophies of warfare engaging with one another. And the Ukrainians, with their mission-style tactics, are doing far, far better than the Russians.
Given that, if the fight descended into a guerrilla war, as some analysts predict, will it give Ukraine a greater edge?
I'm very skeptical that it will devolve into a guerrilla war. I think one of the challenges that we're having in the West right now is we perpetually keep underestimating the Ukrainians and overestimating the Russians. And we seem very reluctant, despite a month of continual battlefield successes, to just say what is glaringly obvious. The Ukrainians are winning this war. And so far, it appears that they're winning it pretty handily. If you know, they'll still need support from the West in terms of weapons and materiel to keep pressure on the Russians. But they have certainly shown themselves more capable of fighters than the Russians. In the event, which I believe is unlikely, that this would sort of have to devolve into a guerrilla-style war, I think you would see the Ukrainians as highly effective guerrilla fighters.
How do you see the role played by anti-armor weapons in the Ukraine-Russia war, particularly the American-made weapons like Javelin?
Well, we're seeing for the first time the wide-scale deployment of some of these new generation anti-tank missiles like the Javelin or the British-made NLAW. And they're incredibly effective against the latest generation tanks. And that is something new. In the past, maybe 15 or even 20 years ago, the latest generation tanks, by and large, their armor was effective enough to protect them from anti-tank weapons. These new anti-tank weapons, that's not the case. And that's why we're seeing time after time Russian tanks, very advanced Russian tanks, being destroyed by small groups of two or three Ukrainians. And that is that's an important trend in this war that everyone should pay attention to. The Russians should pay attention to it, but the United States and NATO should be paying attention to it as well, because particularly in the West, we have what I would call a very platform-centric view of warfare, meaning we tend to invest very heavily in these extremely expensive platforms like technologically advanced battle tanks or ships or aircraft. And what we're seeing is that anti-platform weapons now have the capacity to destroy these very expensive, very advanced platform systems.
So you think the superiority of anti-armor weapons displayed in this war could change warfare tactics in future wars?
I think it could certainly change the balance of power, because it's not just anti-tank missiles that we're seeing the effectiveness of. You know, it's also anti-ship missiles. And so if a military is completely invested in its platforms, while at the same time the anti-platform technologies like these missiles become extremely advanced, you could very quickly see one military that's perceived to be weaker become the stronger. And in many respects, that's what we've seen in Ukraine. You know, the Ukrainians do not have many tanks, yet they're defeating Russian tanks. And it's not with their own tanks, it's with these Javelin missiles. So that's an important trend to be paying attention to.
Sure. As you point out, the anti-armor weapons have proved to be able to turn the tide for an outmatched military. Is it applicable to possible conflicts in some other places, like in the South China Sea or across Taiwan Strait?
I think it certainly is. It's that same idea of the ascendance of anti-platform weapon systems. So, for instance, shore-based missiles we're seeing have now extended ranges and extended lethality. So in any type of naval clash, like one you could imagine seeing in the South China Sea, it would show that there would be an increased level of vulnerability to large groups of capital ships like aircraft carriers and destroyers. So it's an important trend, again, for, you know, not only the Chinese military, but also the American military to watch as they're making decisions on how to invest their resources.
As a former Marine who served five tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, has the Ukraine-Russia war refreshed or changed your view on war?
Well, I think one of the things that I have observed is that the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan frequently were complex morally. The Iraq war was fought on faulty premises. The Afghan war dragged on for years and years. And oftentimes, what we were doing there didn't seem particularly clear. That is not the case in Ukraine. In Ukraine, the stakes are very clear. There is very clearly one side that is in the right here, the Ukrainians, and another side that is the aggressor and in the wrong, and that is the Russians. And so I've been engaged with war for 20 years. This is the fourth war that I've been to. I also covered Syria as a journalist, and it's the most clear-cut war that I have seen in terms of which side we should all be on and who we should all be supporting, and that is the side of the Ukrainians.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Ackerman.继续收看美国观察。俄罗斯入侵乌克兰期间，世界各地的许多街头艺术家也都拿起了他们的画笔和喷漆罐，加入到抵抗俄罗斯侵略的战斗中。在加利福尼亚州，有两位艺术家创作了谴责普京和支持乌克兰难民的壁画。
I stayed anonymous until right now. I've decided to step out in support of the Ukrainian people. As I look at this man right here, the strength and the courage and the bravery, the inspiration. Granted, I might face fines or an arrest for the nature of my work. I'm happy to take that in support of the people of Ukraine, in support of peace. My message is generally one of positive love and peace. Although this piece might appear to be quite violent, it is one that is speaking to the gut feelings of many people today.
Obligation to almost put things on the street about this because that's how the conversations start and then it can live on the internet and that's how, you know, change happens. It's kind of like a resistance, you know, where it's like you're not using, you know, violence or even like anything that would have a negative impact on someone, but you're using art to potentially change people's perspectives. Good art makes you think, but great art makes you do.
以上就是今天美国观察的全部内容，感谢您的收看，我们明天再见。